Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. I guess welcome. It's nice to see everybody. Erev Pesach. I know some people start Erev Pesach very early, but it's always nice to learn. And cleaning can always wait to be a little less, as we always say. But anyways, I want to wish everybody Chag Sameach and you know, all good things. And I don't even know what class is this already. This must be class
11.
Class 11. Okay, class 11, and Vakasha, Dr. Mark, and we'll wish him well, and we'll be back in 2 weeks, continuing after Pesach. Okay, Vakasha, it's all yours.
Okay, well, let me also say, I'm going to get my other computer good right here. The date is the 11th, April 11th, 2022, 10th of Nisan, actually, 11th of Nisan now. If I forget at the end, wish everyone a very nice Pesach with your families, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. If I don't know if anyone's going to be down in Florida, if you are in Fort Lauderdale, you can email me, come by and say hello. Okay, hello everyone. I'm happy to see that Rabbi Barry Hartman is with us, as always. He's made many important contributions privately to me and also in the classes. And I thank him very much for recommending, I think it was 2 weeks ago, to check out the book Message of Israel by Israel Levinthal, rabbi of the Brooklyn Jewish Center. I ordered interlibrary loan. I have a copy here, actually a copy with an inscription from him to Rabbi Sidney Greenberg, who I didn't know who he was. He passed away in 2003, but I looked him up on the internet and I found out who he is. Now, this book has the sermons that I'm not so interested in, but what I am interested in is, I'm really grateful to Rabbi Hartman, is the third of the book, which is his memoirs. And he grew up, his father was Bernard Leventhal, Rabbi Bernard Leventhal, the leading Orthodox rabbi in Philadelphia. Really one of the machers, the heads of Agudas HaRabbanim, a real powerhouse on the Orthodox scene. So to get an inside scoop, I guess, from his son, like many in that era, went to the conservative movement, went to the seminary. I found it very interesting that on page 116, he mentions that he received the degree of Doctor of Hebrew Literature from the seminary, honorary degree in 1920s, just after he got his smicha. And his father and mother came to the graduation ceremony at the seminary. What's relevant to Pesach, so let me share this with you now, and really which is very relevant to what we are doing last semester with in Lieberman, is, of course, Leventhal discusses the issue that he departed from his father's path, went to the seminary, the problems, and he mentions something that I think I'm going to remember, not just this Pesach, maybe every time we sing Chag Gadya, because on pages 198 and 199, he's talking about the Orthodox attacks on Schechter and the seminary. They actually used to call the seminary Schechters, like he went to Schechters. But he says as follows. He said they... this one person, his name is Zelikovich, he was a popular writer, he made a joke on Chag Gadya, on this passage of Chag Gadya, and he did it like pronounced with the Sephardic pronunciation. V'ata shochet, the shochet came, v'shachar l'Torah, and shechted the bull. We all know that. V'asa shochet v'shachar l'Torah. So what is shochet? Shochet is shechter, and so shechter came and he shechted the Torah. The Ata Shochet Shechter came, the Shechet the Torah, and he Shechted the Torah. So that was the joke, that Shechter's destroying the Torah. So every time you say the Chag Gadya, remember, he wants you to remember that Shechter destroyed the Torah. So I thought that was cute. Incidentally, they also refer to Geiger. Geiger in German means violinist. So there's one Hebrew text, I can't remember which one, I have to remember. He keeps referring to this bad guy, the menagin, you know, the player, the musical player, musical instrument person. And I remember thinking, who is this? What's this referring to? And then it hit me that because I put two and two together that he's referring to Geiger. I think it was Geiger's his Urschrift, his book. So Geiger, the violinist, he calls him the menagin. So thank you, Rabbi Hartman, for that. I recently renewed my subscription to this tradition. I hadn't subscribed for probably 20 years. I didn't subscribe to it because, first of all, I thought it was boring. But more than that, I had a bit of a falling out because of not the previous editor, the editor before that. He censored my, wanted to censor things that they was going to write for them. So I said, forget that. But I have to say that Jeffrey Sachs, he's really turned it once again into a very fine journal. I wonder if and if you look at the associate editors and the committees, really top level people. I wonder if there's any controversy going on behind the scenes, because to be provocative and interesting, you're going to ruffle some feathers. But that's what Chakira does. So now you have all sorts of interesting stuff. So why am I mentioning that to you? Because I saw in Rabbi Black's article on pages 111 and 112, it's relevant to what we did just a few semesters ago. He cites this rabbi, he doesn't say the name, it's his Mordechai Halevi of Egypt, Darchei Noam number 9, who speaks about, the article was about smoking, he deals with smoking, including smoking on fast days. And lo and behold, the Darchei Noam, who's in the 17th century, I think, not the 18th, I think 17th, maybe 18th century early, he forbids smoking on all fast days. Why? Muslims refrain from smoking during Ramadan. And if Jews were to smoke on a fast day, that would be a chil Hashem, because the Muslims would look and say, Jews obviously don't respect the fast days because they smoke on them. He says, little wonder that later Ashkenazic writers who live in Christian lands make no mention of refraining from smoking on fast days other than Tisha B'Av. If you notice in this article, he then has a long, long footnote, a Rabbi Blech type footnote, how smoking in Islam, Islamic scholars have long disagreed with regard to whether smoking is forbidden or permitted, etc., etc. It goes on and on, completely irrelevant to the article. Really, mentions how there's one Egyptian scholar who's a maverick who permits smoking in Ramadan. If I was the editor, this is the sort of thing I just take an X to, because there's no relevance to anything. It's if you want to do an article on smoking in Ramadan, fine. But so I remember years ago, I asked one of the editors of Tradition why they don't just X all these irrelevant footnotes that go on forever that have nothing to do with the topic. And what I was told is, no one can delete anything Rabbi Blech puts in, even though that's the job of an editor usually, to take out extraneous things. They said he has a patur that what he submits has to be printed as is. I guess when you reach a certain level, I haven't reached that level yet, because I have a whole list of things that they say it's not relevant. So I'm guilty of the same thing that I'm saying that I would do to Rabbi Blech. Oh, we have some time. I mentioned this book last class. Rabbi Beryl Wine's new book, very relevant to the topic that we're on, how Jewish communities defended orthodoxy. Oh, and you see, of course, the Chasam Sofer and Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. And I said I was going to point out some things that are relevant and also some mistakes. And I'm not a prophet, but I guess I'm a wise man, because I said I am certain that some things in this book were not put in by Rabbi Wein. And lo and behold, just a few days ago, Schneer Lyman has a post on his forum blog about a picture of Yisrael Salanter, a picture that appears in this book. And that was one of the things I was going to show you, and showing that it's not a real picture. And there's even one of you sent me a video that Rabbi Wein gave to Art Scroll, in which he talked about where he got that picture. And he's not at the stage now to investigate matters. It was unfortunate that I saw he said that he can't see anymore. So he's relying on other people. He doesn't really read. He just listens. So some of the things I'm going to show you, I was right in assuming that they were the editor, although he can see somewhat. He sees the picture, and it's a little embarrassing perhaps, because he says he saw the picture and you could see the greatness and you could see the Musser and all that. Well, you might be able to see all that, but you're not seeing that in Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And this picture, actually, the first I saw attributing this picture to Yisrael Salanter is in this book, The Rabbi's Suitcase by Eli Friedwald. What it is he includes letters to his forefather, who was Rabbi Yaakov Reinowitz on the London Basin. So when I read the book, I wrote to him. We had had some correspondence before that, and I said that the picture, by the way, the picture on page 50 is not as Rishol Salanter. So he writes back to me, yes, I cannot count the number of people who have advised me of this. I heard that Rabbi Wein claims to have a genuine picture. He will be included in his soon-to-be-published new book. Well, the genuine picture is none other than the picture of Friedwald. It's a phony picture. It's a false picture. We have no picture of Rishol Salanter, and anyone who's interested in learning more, you can look at Schneer Lyman's article. But what I wanted to show you, how did I conclude that a lot of these pictures, that things in the book were done by editors? Well, I mentioned already Yeshiva University with an H at the end. But let me just show you some other things that it's obvious that this was not, had he reviewed it, he never would have done that. So for instance, here's a picture in the book. It says, Rabbi Dr. Abraham I. Cook. Rabbi Wein knows full well that Rav Cook did not have a doctorate. If you read the book, you learn that Rabbi Wein's father studied in Merkaz HaRav in the 20s. Pretty much everyone knows that Rav Cook never had a doctorate. But Rabbi Wein, unfortunately, is unable to review his own book and look at the pictures, and or he would have corrected that mistake. Incidentally, the interview which I was listening to, which is a wonderful interview, he's still such a great speaker and so interesting, but how he was accepted in the Haredi world, I still can't understand. Almost every time he speaks, he throws in these subtle digs against the Haredim, and he puts them in his writing also, always about or mostly about Zionism, about return to Israel, but also about secular studies, about the response of the Gedolim. Again, it amazes me how it goes over their heads, because if you just listen to what he's saying, he's always subtly knocking the Haredi approach. But he is accepted, I guess, to a certain extent. But let me just give you some other examples of what, just a couple of things. I want to show you a couple of interesting things, and then we'll move on. Well, first of all, this is something that's not from the early book, this book. This is something I already pointed out 10 years ago, and I'm not sure how I've told people to tell him that, but he's not the only one. He insists on referring to the Vilna Gaon as Rabbi Eliel Kramer. There's a thing that people want to show that they're with it sometimes. I'm not referring to him, but others, they'll mention Rabbi Eliel Kramer, and you don't know who they're talking about. But he says Rabbi Eliel Kramer, and that's not correct. The Vilna Gaon was not named Kramer. He had a grandfather who had the name Kramer. But the Vilna Gaon did not have such a name, and he didn't have a last name. The one thing is, what is Kramer? Storekeeper, I believe. He was known as Zalmanovitz, Solomon, but that's not a last name either. He didn't have a last name. So enough already. I'm saying to everyone who's listening, stop calling the Vilna Gaon Eliel Kramer. Also, he mentions here about the Nazir, that the Nazir was secular before he met Rav Cook. Not true. He didn't become a Nazir because of Rav Cook. He was always religious, etc. But what I want to show you now is something interesting. And there's a few other points I'll make next class or the class after that, because some people have asked me to comment on it. But I want to show you this picture as well, because this is something I'm sure the editor did a number on this. He's talking about, look at this paragraph over here. He's talking about in the Sadagor dynasty. A mysterious event occurred during the reign of the brothers and the consequences. One of them, Rav Dov Ber, left the court of Sadagora and moved to the city of Chernivetz. The city was then considered a bastion of the Maskilim, who mocked tradition and especially the court of Sadagora. Now listen to this. Lo and behold, a leader of Sadagora had not only appeared in Chernivetz, period. What do you mean? Now, where's the second part of the sentence? It's supposed to say, lo and behold, a leader of Sadagora had not only appeared in Chernivetz, comma, but XYZ. And then it says, later he led his own Hasidic court, and the officer of Sadagora regarded him as a great tzaddik. So something is missing here. This, obviously, something was removed. So what could have been removed? Well, let me show you what could have been removed. All you have to do is Google the name. And you can find, for instance, an article on the Russian dynasty in the Yivo Encyclopedia. So here's the paragraph, just to give you a sense. Dov Ber, nicknamed Bernu, was the center of a tragic and dramatic scandal and a fierce controversy. After officiating as rabbi in several Moldovan villages, he settled in Husi in 1852, moving around 1866 to the nearby town of Lyova, Bessarabia. Disillusioned with Hasidism and with his role as a tzaddik, he began to keep company with Maskilim. In 1868, following the death of a brother, he experienced a profound personal crisis and decided to abandon his standing as a Hasidic Rebbe. Attempts to persuade him to recant failed, and rumors abounded regarding alleged contacts with missionaries and his desire to convert to Christianity. Fearful of the damage to the reputation of the dynasty, his wife and brothers brought him forcibly to Sadagur in 1869, but Maskilim from nearby Chernivtsi secured his release with the help of the police. And then it goes on to say that he moved to Chernivtsi. He was openly lax in his religious observance. He published a declaration in the Jewish press rejecting Hasidism and espousing Haskalah values. But then after a month and a half, he was brought back. He repented. He came back to Sadagura. But contrary to what Wine says, he did not resume his rabbinical duties and lived in solitude until his death. And that's the famous story. And it even led, as it goes on, it helped. It was one of the things that leading the Sanzer Rebbe to the attacks on Rijin. This is what Rabbi Wine is referring to. He says he was brought there by Maskilim, and then if sentence ends, he must have originally had something saying, and he rejected religion. And it was removed. Either he removed it and didn't fix the sentence, or his editor or his handler, whatever you want to call it. I think this is published by Shire Press, which is the more, it's like the Art Scroll. I'm told it's the Art Scroll. It's the Art Scroll imprint when Art Scroll doesn't want to put. Yeah, it's distributed by Masora Publications, published by Shire Press. I've been told that the Shire Press is just Art Scroll, but when they want to have some a little more edgy stuff, and rather than Art Scroll, they publish under the Shire imprint. But whatever it is, it's something is missing in that sentence, and or maybe it's an example of Hamavin Yavin, that anyone who sees the sentence ending in mid-sentence will be encouraged to look a little further and see what happened. And you might even come across David Asaf's long article on this whole episode, which shook the Hasidic world. Okay, let us continue. I have a couple more things there, but I'll get to it in Mirza Hashem in 2 weeks. We are picking up right in the middle of our discussion of reform, the Eila Divrei HaBris. But before we get to that, because right now we're going to see the Chasam Sofer, we're going to see others who are responding to the issue of prayer in the vernacular, music, things, etc. But the big one, one of the big ones that we know is prayer in the vernacular. We went through the issue that, hey, it's explicit in the Mishnah, in the codes, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam, and yet the rabbis have to assert it. In this book, Chaim Soloveitchik's a medievalist, one of the greatest in our time. He's not a modern scholar, you know, but he knows somewhat, like everyone else who reads, he knows. On page 4, this is volume 3 of his collected essays. I believe there's only going to be 3 volumes. Maybe there'll be another. He also has his Rupture and Reconstruction came out in a book form recently. If you have the article, it has his responses. It's nothing really new. I feel good about these volumes and they become popular because I was one of the people Lippmann Library consulted about publishing it. I couldn't understand why you'd have to consult to publish it. I think it's a big coup to get Chaim Soloveitchik, but being that I had published with Lippmann and sold many books through them, I guess they figured they should ask me. So, of course, I said to go for it. And in the introduction to one of the volumes, or maybe all of them, he says that the best editing he ever got was with Lippmann. So if anyone's interested, please pick it up. But on pages, he has an essay here called The Angle of Deflection. This is in volume 3. And it's his theory on halachic development that basically you can see, if you understand halacha, you could see how it should develop based on the sources. And when you see it moving in a drastically different direction than one would expect it, that's the angle of deflection, he calls it. That's when you have to look for non-halachic forces that are causing this pressure. So instead of the halacha moving in a straight direction, it moves in a completely different direction where you get arguments that you wouldn't expect. You get conclusions you wouldn't expect. So that's one of his major approaches. And then he gives an example that he says this isn't just in medieval times. He says that it occurs frequently in the modern period in dealing with the reform movement and in our day in treating the halachic status of women. And he says as follows, and listen to this, because this is right where we are now in Eilat Divrei HaBris. For example, many of the changes introduced in the Hamburg Temple at the close of the second decade of the 19th century by the reform movement were ones that were halachically trivial. Some were even practices of long standing in the traditional synagogue. The first reform was praying in German rather than in Hebrew. The permissibility of praying in any language is explicitly stated in a Mishnah in Sota. Indeed, the classic commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, Or HaChaim, Rav Avraham Avli, stated that it was preferable to pray in a language that one understood. That's referring to the Magen Avraham, where I couldn't remember exactly what he said. And it is true. If you look at, I'll read you the Magen Avraham in a minute. The Magen Avraham says it's preferable to pray in a language you understand. Tens of thousands of Jews had prayed for centuries in Yiddish. The reformers introduced an organ played by a Gentile. However, hadn't Rav Moshe Isserles, in his authoritative glosses on the Shulchan Aruch, permitted a Gentile flutist on the Sabbath to introduce a more joyous note of celebration during the marital feast? We dealt with all this. I have to say it's a little poetic license here because the Ramah doesn't mention flutist. He just mentions musical instrument. It could be a guitar too. It could be any instrument. Moreover, and then he goes, he says he also stated that the ban on playing music on the Sabbath for fear they might fix a musical instrument no longer applied. And then he says as follows. The rabbis who opposed the reforms perceived that the purpose of these changes in the traditional Jewish rite of prayer was to make the Jewish service resemble the Gentile one. This was simply another step in the process of assimilation and the destruction of Jewish distinctiveness. The central issue was the intent of the reformers, not their actions. Who, however, could prove that the purpose of the reformers was not to elevate by music the hearts of the worshipers to a more profound divine service. The rabbis were thus obliged to demonstrate to the Senate of Hamburg that the deeds of the reformers were contrary to Jewish law. The result was the famous Eilat Divrei HaBrit, a collection of responsa, many signed by justly famed scholars, characterized by forced and unpersuasive arguments. So that's not me saying it, it's Chaim Soloveitchik. All because there were no halachic categories to address the real question, the illegitimate purpose of the reformers. But I made that exact point, that the issue wasn't the halacha. You could argue halachically that what they're doing is permissible, but the result of it would have been the destruction of traditional Judaism, even if it's technically permissible. So they had to find a way to, and notice they didn't have Das Torah. Maybe if in the early 19th century they had this doctrine of Das Torah, the Chasam Sofer would have just declared, ex cathedra, I say it's us, sir, end of story. But you can't say that to the people, and you can't say that to the Hamburg Senate. So they're struggling. They can't say, well, we can't permit this because the slippery slope, before you know it, people won't be observing at all because they'll be assimilating to the non-Jews. That's not an argument you could use. You had to come up with something halachic. And then, after saying this, Chaim Soloveitchik says as follows, in one short paragraph. I don't know why you and the centrists, they might not like this. The same, quote, absence of categories has arisen in our own day regarding women reading the Torah or the Megillah. The question is not the halachic permissibility of the performances. This is obvious. But where the women's movement is headed, will it lead to attempts to alter the halachic rulings that the sages had instituted or are derived from the Bible? Question mark. So what Chaim Soloveitchik is saying, he says, when it comes to women reading the Torah and Megillah, not just Megillah, Torah, he's saying if the women want to take out the Torah and read it among themselves, you don't have an Aliyah, you don't say the Birkas HaTorah and Aliyah. If women want to take out the Torah and read the Torah, he says, the question is not the halachic permissibility of these performances. This is obvious. Maybe he uses the word performances to show it's not halachic, but he's saying that it's obvious. It's a davar pashut, that there's no problem halachically. However, the question is, where is it heading? Is this just the first step to egalitarianism or other things? But I thought that was an interesting point by Chaim Soloveitchik. If you want to see the Magen Avraham, take a look in 1 Shulchan Aruch Hor HaChaim 101 number 4, where the Shulchan Aruch says Yachal Hispala B'chol Lashon Sheyirtza. You can daven in any language you want. And the Magen Avraham says, he quotes the Asara Ma'amaros and Menachem Zion Yafano, Demutav Hispala B'lashon Shemevin, Eino Mevin Lashon HaKodesh. It's better to daven in a language you understand than if you don't understand Hebrew. And then he says, so too it says in Sefer Hasidim. So what does Sefer Hasidim say? Well, if you if you open up the Sefer Hasidim, no reformer, the Sefer Hasidim, in Tavkuf Peichet, 588, it says, if someone comes to you, Miyavo Elecha Misha Eino Mevin Lashon Ivri, V'hu Yirei Shamayim. If someone comes to you and he doesn't know Hebrew and he wants to be mechavin, understand, you have kavana, or if there comes before you a woman, it was understood the women in those days didn't know Hebrew, you should say to them, sheyomadu hatfilos b'lashon shemevinim. You should learn the tfilos in the language you understand. Ki hatfila eina ela b'havanas halev. The whole point of tfila is under the heart should understand it. V'im halev eino yodeya. If the heart doesn't understand it, if the heart doesn't know what the mouth is saying, mama willo. What good is prayer? Sefer Hasidim says, if you don't understand what you're saying. So the Sefer Hasidim says, better to pray in the language you understand. And you see the same exact thing in Tavshin Pehei, where he says, Tovo Admishispalo, Vikra Shema, Ubrachos. You should better daven and say Shema and Brachos, but Lashon Shemavin Bo. In the language you understand, rather than saying it, Balshona Kodesh Ve'Eino Mevi. And he quotes sources to say he derives from the Navi that says that. And then he goes on. This is, he says, you should also be careful. If you can daven, Im Yocho Yispal, but Kavona Yispal, Vim Lav Al Yispal, Lafisha Tfil Tzrecha Kavona. This isn't a common view in medieval times going earlier that Talmudic times that if you can't have Kavona, don't daven. What good is davening if you don't have kavana? But so the Achronim already say that none of us have kavana anyway. So if we're going to wait for kavana, we'll never daven. So it's best to daven because better that we daven without kavana, we'll come to have kavana. So often the idea is you do something even if it's not at the best level because you'll reach the best level. But the Sefer Hasidim was saying, he wasn't saying that. He was saying, if you don't have kavana, if your mind is on the Yankees game or something, wait till you can daven. Remember, it's also, there's an issue, especially in Shacharis, because if you put tefillin on and you have tefillin on and then you're thinking about all these dvarim b'teilim, it's a problem. But it's not only, it's mincha also, myriv. Let us return to where we are. I want to pull up for you the Eila Divrei Habris. Let's see, pick up where we left off. If you recall, the last thing we saw, I think, was about the instruments, the rabbis, the sages of Prague. And the sages of Prague, it's a problem because they have an organ in the Altnoy show. How far back does this go? Well, we don't know exactly. Yechiel Goldhaber has an article in the journal Kovetz Beis Aharon V'Yisrael, a very good journal published by the Karlin Stolen Hasidim. And in one of the issues, he has a whole article about music, about singing, and also about instruments he deals with. And he brings proof as early as 1668. He has another proof, but I don't think it's such a good proof. In 1668, we have a matseva in Prague. Here it is from 1668, where it says about this person that he was mikat. Here it says chevlez marim, but he says in the note, it appears it should say haklez marim, that he was from the group that the instruments hamakdimim. They would be in shul before Kabbalah Shabbos. They would play the instrument. That's what that means there. But notice it says we're talking about more than one instrument. he also brings a source that actually he's not the first one to bring it. Rav Yitzchak Hoffman brings it in his Mahamid Hohel, page 15. We have a Siddur that's published in Amsterdam in 1678, and it has the list of Kabbalah Shabbos for Prague, and it says that it says as follows. This is a Zemer Na'eh from Rabbi Shlomo Singer, which they menagnin, which they play in the Meisel Synagogue, not just the Altnoy. We know Altnoy Synagogue had an organ, but this is the Meisel Synagogue. But Ugav, Nevalim, I guess harps. I don't know. I think Neval is used for other instruments as well. But the Koda Machadodi. So what you have here is we have testimony. If you go to Prague, you'll see you have a bunch of synagogues there. One is the Meisel Synagogue. And we see that they played an organ and they also played this other instrument. Furthermore, he shows us that not just in Prague and not just in the Altnoy Shul, but we have evidence that in Nikolsburg they played with instruments, and even in Frankfurt they played with instruments. So this was it was a practice. It was done. Following the letter of the Prague sages, we have another letter by Rav Mordechai Bennett. We spoke a little bit about Mordechai Bennett originally, Rav of Nikolsburg, and here he attacks the Italian rabbis, Rav Shem Tov Samun and Yaakov Chai Rakanati, and says regarding them, that they're going to be called to account for giving such a permission for the reformers. Now, why such harsh language? After all, we know that Shem Tov Samun just said you can use an organ. He wasn't speaking about Shabbos. And Rakanati relied on the fact that on a wedding you can have a non-Jew play. So what's the difference in a wedding and a shul? Rav Mordechai Bennett focuses on the organ and distinguishes between having a wedding where you can play music and Shabbos in shul, because it's not a Devar Mitzvah. He says as follows, and for those who want to check this out later, on page 21, I don't see the page numbers on the copy on HebrewBooks.org, but I have it here. He says as follows on this page. I think it's this page. I'll read it to you. He says that davening with music is not a dvar mitzvah. He says, "Ein ba toelas kol kach letzorek tefillah mamash." It doesn't really bring you any value, music, to the prayers. But isn't this the crux of the argument? What Rekanati was saying was that instrumental music does have a tohelet, as well as we know kunitz and chorin, and it is a dvar mitzvah. And that's why it's permissible, because it does create an environment that's suitable. And even Samun also says that he's not referring to Shabbos, but he says that the organ has value. Both Samun and Rekanati say that music is a Dvar Mitzvah, that is, it helps in its tefillah. And but Rav Mordechai Bennett concludes, he refers to the Sefer there, he refers to it as Aven, if you could see it, or Noga. You have an Oga at Tzedek, but the other book was called Or Noga, so he calls it Aven, that's evil, wickedness. Following this letter comes a letter from a rabbi named Eliezer Lov. He was from Moravia, and he was author of not the most famous rabbi today, but he's quoted in the Tshuva literature. His sefer is called Shemen Rokeach, and he begins by noting that the reformers in Hamburg have an organ with non-Jew playing the organ, based on Yaakov Chai Rakanati's Tshuva. But then he says Chorin went further and changed the prayer book that was established by Anshe Knesset Gedolah, and then he blasts Chorin. For the most part, Rav Shem Tov Samun or Yaakov Chai Rakanati are ignored by the respondents, because everyone knows that they're not reformers, although they got caught, I guess, in this matter by responding to the reformers. But Chorin, he knew exactly what was going on in Germany. And he had a reputation himself as a reformer, as a quasi-reformer before even this incident. So he was never forgiven. And no one mentions Kunitz. Now, just as we saw earlier, one of the rabbis says, Rav Mordechai Bennett says that Chorin's an ignoramus. Lov calls him an ignoramus and says he can't rely on his rulings. And it's not true. He was far from an ignoramus. He says that the fact that the people in Germany, why do they turn to Chorin and why do they write to Italy? He says that it must be that they knew the local rabbis wouldn't support them and they were interested in falsifying the law. I wouldn't put it that way. I would say that they knew, at least with regard to the Italians, that they could get rabbis who could answer the question without knowing the broader circumstances, without knowing really what was going on in Germany. I guess you could say that's falsifying the law. Now, he says on page 23, he has this at the bottom paragraph of page 23, he says as follows. He says, you, as rabbis in Germany, who are close to the Chil Hashem, you have to be zealous for God. That from the day of its founding was the joy for the whole world. That is Frankfurt, L'shem Oteila. Everyone knows about the Frankfurt, what type of city it was, the great Gedolim who were there. So he says, don't falter. Stand in the Chutzar Asarim. Stand together with the leaders of your city. That they should not give a hand to those who do wickedness, and don't allow Chevra Chadasha, Noya Zepta, a new sect. Why not? All kings, all rulers want to prevent the arising of a new sect. And he says that based upon what we've heard, the princes in Hamburg, they're Tamimim, Mishalei, they're good people. And they love the truth and want to do right. And therefore, you should go to them, go to the Chatzar, and by you speaking there, Beis Rishayim Yishamed, the house of the wicked will be overthrown. Zros Rishayim Tishavarna, the arm of the wicked shall be broken. What he's saying is that you need to go to the rulers in Hamburg, the Senate, and have them shut this temple down. And how do you do this? Because you tell them that this is a Chevra Chadasha, this is a Noya Zekta, that this is a new sect. It's not really Judaism. It's a sectarian movement. I always heard growing up that Reform Judaism is not Judaism. They're Jews, but we always said it's not Judaism. So if it's not Judaism, it's some concocted thing, that's a sect, and they will shut down the temple. As we've said already on a few different occasions, I do believe that listeners to this program would be very troubled by the appeal to the government, certainly in Chutz La'aretz, but I think most of us would not want a situation, even in Israel, where the government would shut down non-Orthodox synagogues. But that's what he says. And the same sentiment appears later. If you look on the book on page 30, page 26, there's a letter from an Italian rabbi, the rabbi of Trieste, Avraham Eliezer Alevi. He actually had a nice correspondence with the Chosm Sofer. He says to him, that the rabbi, he says in his letter, the rabbis and the Chochmei Ador who are sitting on the seats of Hora'ah, that is rabbis of community, et cetera, they should go, b'chatzar ha'malchus, go to the rulers, and they should stand in the breach, et cetera, or dofosam ad chorma, they should persecute them, you know, to destroy these new communities. And this was always how the secular government was envisioned by the authorities. He used the secular government to punish the evildoers. The communities would use the secular government to punish people who did bad things in the Jewish communities if they could. Often the Jewish community had the authority to punish. So, for example, they could put people in their own jails and lash them. If you go to Prague, and you go into the Altneuschule, you have that room right in the lobby there. It looks like a little jail cell, and people assume that that's where they would keep Jewish prisoners. They would put them there. That way they can still hear Kriyas HaTorah and things like that, davening. But that's one theory. Another theory is that that's where they used to keep the money. But we know that they had their own prisons because the Shaar Ephraim of Buda, Ephraim HaKohen, He has a question there. Does the Jewish prison need a mezuzah on it? And we have times when they would, if they thought they were really bad, they couldn't control them, they'd hand them over to the government. So That's what's going on. And the letters go on. They talk about how sinful the reformers are. They refute all of their suggestions. There's letters by Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the Chasam Sofer, other rabbis, including the Italian rabbis. But that was important to have the Italian rabbis. But let me show you another thing here. Hold on a second. Get back here. By one of the Italian rabbis, because I think just like we saw with Rabbi Wein's book, I think maybe there's some censorship going on here with one of the Italian letters. On page 50, the letters of the rabbis of Padua. So in the middle here, it says, right at the bottom, it says that it should be forbid to play the organ on Shabbos, af al yadei nachri, bimkomos shenahaguba isur mekodem, in a place where there is already a prohibition established. And then there's three dots. That seems to imply that something was removed. What would have been removed? And what's the point of saying bimkomos shenahaguba isur mekodem? The fact that the rabbis of Padua agree that it's forbidden to play an organ in a shul in places where they've already established it is forbidden. What they're saying is that in places where they haven't established it as forbidden before, where it already was the minimum to use an organ, like in Prague or places in Italy, let's say, then it wouldn't be forbidden. And that's presumably what was cut out, where they elaborated on. However, in places where they already are playing the organ, then there's no problem continuing to do that. But in this sort of book, which was trying to convince the Jews of Germany that you can't have organs, and was also going to be translated and shown to the Hamburg Senate, you can't have a letter that says that in places where they don't play the organ, you can't institute it, but in places where they've already been playing it, it's okay. So they cut that out. That's how I assume we have to understand those three dots. And the letters continue along this vein. On pages 68 to 69, you actually have a letter from Rav Shem Tov Samun, in which he retracting his earlier ruling, according to the Rav of Trieste, Rabbi Reconati, also retracted his ruling, but we don't have a letter from him saying as much. But with all the pressure, that's what rabbis usually do. When there's pressure, rabbis usually retract. It takes a very strong rabbi to withstand the pressure, especially in a case like this, when you have all the rabbis turning against you. What I want to show you now is, I just turned to the page. This is the letter of Rabbi Shem Tov Samun. It's cute because it was sent along with the letter from the rabbis of Livorno, all the Chachamim. He says that he wants to, he comes as well, Levatel HaMa'orin, what is it? To be Mevatel, the Ma'orin, Chadashim Mikarov Ba'o. This is a nice Melitza. I know we have some people interested in Melitza. If you look in Sota 48a, it talks about Yochanan Kohen Gadol. It says, Hu bitel et ha-ma'orin. He nullified the awakeners. What is the awakeners? The Gemara says, the Levim would stand on a platform and they would quote the Pasuk from Tehillim, Ura lama tishan Hashem, awake, why do you sleep, O war? So Yochanan the Kohen Gadol says, you know, what kind of covenant is it? You say to God, awake, and what do you mean? Does it mean he's sleeping? He never sleeps. And it gives an explanation of what this pasuk means. So that's what it means in context. But he, here he's, the Melitza is, the Ma'orin, because he has the two dots, the squiggly marks there. Later on, actually, it's what he's saying is, I believe he's reading this Ma'orin as a pun for Ma'arin, meaning those who subvert or who undermine the law. That's what I think it is. He's saying, and then it ends his letter in 1819. Notice he signs the letter. Yom Shenichpa Bo Ki Tov. the day that is doubled, Kitov, that's referring to Tuesday. Rabbinic writers sometimes will throw in this melitza, because look in the beginning of Breishis. The only day where it says Tov twice is Tuesday. So you say Yom Shenichlobo, the expression Kitov. The next letter, we're getting to the end here, pages 78-79. We don't have time to go through all the letters of the Gedolim here, but this is, here he says, his name is Yaakov. Doesn't give you his last name, but his last name is Orberbaum. Rav of Lisa, Mechaber of the, well, we know him as the Nesivos. If you're Israeli, the Tivot HaMishpat, but the Nesivos. You know, the Katzos and the Nesivos. They also have the Chavos Das, Taurus Kitten, and other works. Now, this is a fascinating letter, because he says in things that I've alluded to it, but I just want to show you some of the things he says. It's not going to make you happy, I think, many of you, but I'm not here to make you happy. I'm here to tell you what he said. Doesn't mean you have to be happy with it, and I'm not saying that today any rabbi is going to get up and use this, his language, but it's interesting to show the approach. He says, well, he begins by saying, right in the paragraph, the third paragraph here, that regarding an organ on Shabbos, that the people who permitted it said that it's a shvus b'mkom mitzvah. He says, I don't see any mitzvah at all or any connection to a mitzvah. Va'adarabah, isur ika v'fil b'chol. He says it's forbidden to have music in the shul. He's saying ugav, but it refers to all music, we'll see, even during the week. Same thing the Chasam Sofer says. Why? Because the Chasam, because the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch say that we can't, since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, we can't play musical instruments. Now, the time we can play musical instruments is when it's a mitzvah, a sudas mitzvah, or simchas chasam v'kala. But davening, there's no connection of that. We understand why at a sudas mitzvah or at a chasam v'kala you dance, but you don't dance in shul. You don't dance in tefillah. So what possible reason could there be for music? No reason, which makes it usur. And then he says, as I said, you can, but these people, they invented this idea that in tefillah, you can also have music. But he goes on. Tefillah, he says, where do we see that there's a concept in davening of simcha? Adarabah, he says, it's mevuar v'niglahu, she'ikar tefillah seinu b'kash seinu hu al-kapar estait. The main focus of davening is on we're repenting. We're saying how bad we are. Before davening, it says we have to, collect ourselves. And the Gemara says, it says in Brachos, you don't stand to daven not for sadness and not laziness, etc., etc., but by simcha shel mitzvah. You should approach prayer from an atmosphere and joy with the joy of mitzvah. So you might say, well, that means that you should have simcha when you daven. But he explains that no. And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, I'll read it for you here. In, let's see, forget now where it's, he'll cite it a little later, but it's not, what he says is that this is only for before you pray, you're supposed to have that in your mind. You're supposed to feel good and happy, but not during the actual prayer. And in fact, that's the Lashon, as I recall. He says, if you look in the Tzadi Gimel, he says, for an hour before you daven, you should yichavim libo. You should have your mind in a certain way, and then it goes on and talks about how you should have simcha. But this is in the section kodem shispalo, and then you have simcha going divrei tanchumin shel Torah. So he understands this all referring to before davening. And what do you do during davening? He says as follows: if you go before a human king, umachusad ara. He says, if you come before a human king to to fall for your life because you sinned against him. Imagine, he says, you come, this is the bottom line of, the bottom line, he says, if you come before a human king to plead for your life and repent for your sins, and you come before him with musical instruments, he's going to be furious. Can you imagine? You come before the king and you're asking him, please spare our lives, you know, let us live in peace, et cetera, et cetera. And you come with musical instruments, he'll think you're crazy. What does simcha have to do with when you have bechi, crying, and tachanunim? But in a time where you don't have an avon, a sin, then you can come with shir. So, for example, at a simcha, at a wedding. But davening, you're going to be happy? No, you need to be quiet and fearful. That's what davening is. And then he says, goes on, certainly when it deals with God. When the Beis HaMikdash was around, he goes on, when was it possible to do simcha? You have a simcha space shoeva, for instance. Etc. Then you had a great simcha. However, from the day that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and no more Ruach HaKodesh and no more Devua, the only way we can repent is through our prayers. And how could you, Echna Volafon of Bashir and Klezemer? How can you come before him with Shir and Klezemer? It's almost like he's saying you can't come before him singing. Because if you're coming before a king and you're pleading for your life, would you sing also? No, you wouldn't sing. But that's his lashon. Echna Volafon of Bashir and Klezemer. It's as if the Nesivos is saying you just, I mean, if you think of prayer this way, that it's just pleading for our life, then what are you singing for? He says, "Ein anu rishaim rakos ader shivcho uspalo b'derech hachotet if ne'amelch b'zav adam." He says, our davening before God should be no different than our requesting things, praying for our life before a human king. Lachein lo matzino etera rak abesimcha sosam akala. Shasimcha batzmusa mitzvah. Because only when you're at a chasana, then that's the mitzvah to rejoice. But other times, absolutely not. Masha ain't came to tefillah. So he says, there's no question that this is not, God does not want this. And then he goes on to say, that's just during the week, that you can't ever have a musical instrument show. On Shabbos, he goes on that it's certainly, it's forbidden. Vafilu b'chol asari, et cetera, et cetera. And then he does the point I mentioned about, what does it mean? Ain omdin lis palo. Although I don't think that's the pshat necessarily. I'll give you an example of something else where I don't think necessarily what he's saying is the pshat. Here, I'll show you. He quotes an example where it says where Abaye was sitting here, and this is Brachos 30b. The Gemara relates, Abaye was sitting before his teacher, Rabba, and Rabba saw, they should have put an H at the end, it's Rabba, and Rabba saw that he was exceedingly joyful. He said to Abaye, it's written, rejoice with trembling. One's joy should not be restrained. So he's saying, he's saying this, it's something here you see that, you know, we shouldn't really have joy. And he says the most joy is with klishir. So if Rabba tells Abaye he shouldn't be so joyful, then kavachomer, we shouldn't have musical instruments. That makes us have joy. But I mean, I don't know what one thing has to do with the other, but that's his argument. And then he continues, hey, look, this is a very austere approach to prayer. Can you imagine getting up and telling people today, when you pray, you shouldn't have simcha, you shouldn't have song, you should feel as if the sword is hanging, Damocles' sword, you know, it's hanging right over you. That's not what we do. You don't need to walk around with a guitar and a saxophone like you saw 2 weeks ago or last week to understand. I mean, that we have singing, we get into it this way. And we all know that if we're going before Putin, you know, he decides to turn on the Jews and they have to send Rabbi Lazar there, you know, to try to, you know, request mercy on the Jews. He's not going to come with and start singing before Putin or anything like that. But music is not something new. We've been saying music for a long time. It's not just in the Beis HaMikdash. But you see how his conception of prayer. And then he goes on and talks about the importance of belief based on faith, not seichel. We don't need to get involved with that. And then he concludes, and this will be the last thing, and this will be the last of the letters we look at today. Let's see, pull it up here on page 80. He concludes as follows, and this is the Nesivos. Most people don't know that the Nesivos, they just know him from his halachic writings. They don't know him from this letter. On page 80, he concludes the paragraph beginning, where is it? Velo. Just, well, it's not actually the conclusion, but he says velo. What does he say? Listen to this. After explaining how you have to be a good citizen and all this stuff, he says, not just us, B'nai Yisrael, are, you know, obligated in this, but every nation and language is obligated in this, as we've seen that the Malchus and the Shultonim, the governments in every Medina are makpid, shetzarich kol adam lios nesar be'azikei emunos natural. All governments insist that people be connected to their particular religions. The shaloyu nechlakin, and that they shouldn't be in agudas, they shouldn't be split up. The aset kol chad mashlibo chafetz, they shouldn't be divided into different groups where everyone does what they want. Ki bazet talekim hamadina, because in this, the whole nation depends on the fact that everyone stays connected to their religion and not make new religions. So already you see here, again, this the point we have. He's saying that the reformers are, they're not loyal. They're creating a new sect. That's something dangerous. The government won't want this. So we can use this to shut them down. But then he goes even further. Shaharei kol birurei hachashos v'sichsuchim shebein adam l'kaveiro. He says, for all arguments and disputes between one man and another, bimkom she'ein edim, if there's no witnesses, einam rak l'yedei shvua. The only way we can determine who's lying, if there's no witnesses, is we make them take an oath. And the whole purpose of the oath is only based on whether you believe. What he's saying here is that those who have no religion, namely the reformers, are not regarded as trustworthy people. Their oath in a court of law would not be acceptable. He's saying that the reformers are not, can't be good citizens because they don't practice Judaism. They don't practice a real religion. They invented some religion. But that also means that they're a danger to the functioning of society because you can't trust them because when everyone goes to court, you can't believe their oaths because they're not believers. This is like Mesira, you could say, but in the reverse. Now he's being maser the reformers that he thinks is okay to be maser them, to inform on them. And then we conclude in the paragraph, the second last full paragraph, he says, just like we believe that God controls the world, so we believe that the king and the government is the chosen one of God. And just like we ask in our prayers to rebuild the temple, so that we can observe the mitzvot the way we should, receive the Shechina again, and everyone will be gathered in the land of Israel. So too, we request in prayer the welfare of the kingdom, because that's basic. We can't observe our religion without a government that runs things smoothly and properly. And he concludes in sum, Ein b'chol tefilah seinu. In our prayers, there's no opposition to the peace of the Malchus Shloma. Its peace is our peace, because the reformers were arguing that we need to say, if we want to be loyal Germans, we don't believe anymore in a return to the land of Israel. Our messianic era is here in Germany. And the implication is that if you're hoping to be redeemed and brought to the land of Israel, then you're not really a loyal citizen to Germany, because your loyalty is to this far-off messianic kingdom that's going to come. So you see the Nesivos here says just the opposite, that we are very loyal to the government. And this is a response, of course, and an explanation as to why we can pray to return to Zion and still be loyal to the government. I think it's also, you can see that this is like, it's very spiritual, the messianic hope. it's not naturalistic in any way. So we will end here. What we're going to do next class, we have one more letter to really to finish out the book, and that's the Chasam Sofer. And then we're going to move into the Chasam Sofer's arguments, because in many ways, as I said, he is remembered as creating the response to the reform. And he has a few letters, and each letter needs to be looked at carefully. We'll begin by looking at the, if you can believe it, Aaron Chorin is forced to retract. It's a short-lived retraction, but he retracts, and we'll see that next class. So now I want to, let me take the questions. Time really flies when we're having fun. And Barry or Hartman says, yeah, the Leventhal book's a phenomenal book. Well, I only read the memoir. Now maybe I think I should read some of his sermons as well, but the memoir is nice. And Susanna doesn't think it's cute. I think I said it's cute. The when you read polemics, as I do often, it's all cute because I don't take any of them seriously. In fact, with regard to Schechter, I'll just tell you. It's in the wine book. He says as follows on page 237. I think we will move into maybe we'll deal with Salman Schechter as well. But on page 237, he says, let me read to you. Salman Schechter created a new idea about Judaism, which he called Catholic Israel. Then he says, this concept was an expression of his belief that although the Torah was not divine, and therefore neither were its commandments, nevertheless, Jewish law had been adopted by the Jewish people and therefore had a binding effect. Where does Salman Schechter ever say that the Torah is not divine? He doesn't say that. Catholic Israel is not saying that about Jewish law, about the Torah. The Torah is not divine. He did believe the Torah is divine. Catholic Israel deals with the oral law, and but he's not Catholic. Salman Schechter never says that the Torah is not divine. No. As far as I know, he never says anything near that. But okay, if you think it's wrong for me to say that the Shochet shechted the Torah and say that's cute, I take it back. Paul says that he also recently renewed his subscription, and he agrees regarding Sachs's editorship, much more lively, wider contributors, including people who are not even in the Orthodox world. I don't need to mention names, but if you know who the writers are, I give him a lot of credit. And my return to the tradition after 25 years will be in the next issue. Not such an important piece, a translation of something from one of the Gedolei Yisrael in Germany. I'm very impressed with what he's done. Look, the Kellner article alone. I'm just waiting to see letters to the editor from the Kellner article last issue. If you haven't seen it, I'm surprised that got through. So, but I'm impressed. It's letting Menachem Kellner give his position, and very nice. Look, if you're not going to be, if you're predictable, and you're just going to say things that everyone expects you to say, it's boring. That's why Chakira, although it comes out of Flatbush, it was so interesting because it was publishing all sorts of interesting stuff, and the editor's position was that we'll publish it. We don't have to agree with it, but as long as it's in the broad Orthodox camp. The problem with tradition is, because it's associated with the RCA, it has these issues. I'll tell you something. You might recall about 10 years ago, a couple of years, the Sorenbog began in 2008, so it was about 10 or 12 years ago, the RCA wanted to give some publicity to the RCA and tradition. So for about 6 months, the Svarim blog became the tradition Svarim blog. They wanted to, and they were going to pay for all the editing and everything. It only lasted 6 months because then people started complaining. They didn't think that the RCA should be connected to it. And this is when the blog had maybe 800 people signed up. Now thousands of readers read it. So what were the two problems? One was the blog, the comments. We don't censor the comments. So there are people saying, well, if it's an RCA blog, we have to censor the comments. And they tried their own blog, by the way, tradition, if you remember, for a couple of years, but it wasn't successful. The second one is there were some people who were complaining about the posts of Mark Shapiro. that they're a little too edgy, and they wanted someone in the RCA to read over my posts before they could be posted. Well, the editor said, no way, we're not Shapiro, not anyone. Oh, and they didn't want non-Orthodox people posting as well, which the editor's attitude was, if there's nothing, if you know, what's the problem? It just, by the way, the old tradition, Jose Faur also had an article in it under the Wurzburger ring. But that was it. It was my posts, which are, they seem to be popular, and I don't see any problem with it. And all the RCA rabbis read them anyway, but and the comments. But so I give a lot of credit to the new editor. Harvey Cohen says, I think the smoking info will be interesting because they show how Jewish practice is influenced by other religions. You're talking about the Darche Noam. A few classes ago, we dealt with this, that there are certain practices which the rabbis say that because it's a Chil Hashem. Rav David C. Hoffman quotes, I forget who he quotes, but he also adopts this, you can't smoke in shul, because the Christians don't smoke in church, so we can't smoke in shul, it's a Chil Hashem. We gave a number of examples of it. Yes, and Harvey, you're right, the name Dov Ber is a favorite in Chabad, but not just in Chabad. That's Dov Ber, you have others as well. Ezreal says, I guess that means Ezreal is not in Israel now. He's back. So thank him. Welcome back, Israel. In the Tzavah the Netzivos, note 8, he writes how one should not be happy except while doing a mitzvah, as one should be sad because he has committed many errors in his lifetime. I did not know that. So I thank you, Israel. I think we're getting, now we get a sense of who the Netzivos was. I guess he was more dour and that type of personality. If he says that in general, you shouldn't be happy. That's interesting. We know Breslov. Mitzvah gedol aliyos besimcha. It's a great mitzvah to be sameach. And I've told you a number of times what the Brisker Rav turned it on its head. Not mitzvah gedol aliyos besimcha, simcha gedol aliyos bemitzvah. It's a great simcha to be doing a mitzvah. And that's, I guess, so now we see the Nesivo said the same thing. Not much in the way of comments today, just a few comments. So we will end here. Again, to wish you all have a wonderful and meaningful Pesach, and pick up, God willing, in 2 weeks. And Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Okay, I second that. And by the way, I totally agree how traditions in it's in the world. I guess we all, if Paul Shaviv, Mark Shapiro, I don't know, and Jake Hellman all agree, I don't know, we makes it at least a mezumen, at least a kosher mezumen, but it really is, I agree, he's done a wonderful job in editing and all kinds of interesting articles. Anyways, okay, we look forward to learning with you. I know it's Erev Pesach, so we have a lighter week. Tomorrow, Rachel Sharansky Danziger will be completing her series. I think her talk on Sefer Shmot, the ins and outs and freedoms. I think tomorrow's topic is entitled Between the Exodus and the Haggadah. She will be referring to Pesach, of course. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern. Wednesday, 8 p.m., Dr. Sokolow will continue or conclude his series on how Tanakh evolved, the regular class. And then I know we're having a discussion this morning. My schedule is a little bit up in the air. So please, God, I will be giving a follow-up share on the Haggadah. I think it'll be on Thursday. The question Thursday, Friday. I just don't know the exact time. Probably be in the morning. We're driving to New York for Yontif and whatever. So I'll send that up by email. It's a little bit unmesudar. I know Pesach is the holiday of Seder order. We normally we're very organized, but this okay ad hoc share. Whoever can make it, great. And okay. Anyways, I want to wish everybody well. And we look forward to learning with you. And as I mentioned, the post-Pesach Shirim, I think they're pretty much posted on the website. And please, God, before Pesach, we will send out an email. During Pesach, you can start, to register for those classes. I think we put together nice learning opportunities. And we'll probably add to it a little bit as we go on. But some of the continuing classes and, of course, a whole bunch of new series. So I want to wish everybody well, and we should hear good news and have a lot of time. We look forward to learning with you this week, if possible, and afterwards, and after Pesach. And like always, invite a friend to join, one of this year. Okay, everybody, Laila Tov.
Toda rabba, Laila Tov.
Bakasha. Amen. Amen.
Freilich and Pesach.
There you go.
Be well, everyone.
Okay, be well, okay. You got an extra 3 hours to clean. Yes, okay. So, all right.